welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, August 25th, 2021. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline on today's paper is Pandemic Bends Curve on Iowa's Prison Population by Kat Russell. A greater share of inmates in Iowa's prisons have been vaccinated against COVID-19 than the state's overall eligible population, interviews and public health records show. Roughly 71% of inmates currently incarcerated in the state prison system are vaccinated, according to data provided by the Iowa Department of Corrections. In contrast, the latest data released to the public shows that less than 57% of all Iowans aged 12 and above are fully vaccinated. As of last Thursday, nearly 5,000 inmates in the state prison facilities have tested positive for COVID-19 since the pandemic began. Of those, 4,897 are considered to have recovered. There were at least 7 active COVID-19 cases late last week in Iowa prison facilities. One at the Iowa Medical Classification Center near Coralville, 3 at the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison, and 3 at the Newton Correctional Facility in Newton. Additionally, about 730 state prison staff members have tested positive for COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic. Of those, 717 are considered recovered. There were currently 13 prison staff members with the infection, 2 at the Anamosa State Penitentiary, 3 at the Clarinda Correctional Facility, and 1 at the Fort Dodge Correctional Facility, 1 at the Iowa Correctional Institute for Women in Mitchellville, 1 at the Iowa State Penitentiary, and 5 at the Mount Pleasant Correctional Facility. The numbers provided to the Gazette show state prisons have vaccinated 6,062 incarcerated individuals since the vaccines first became available last December. Of those, 5,520 remain housed in state prison facilities. Additionally, the Corrections Department said about 61% of the state's prison staff have reported being fully vaccinated. Again, higher than the rate for the state's overall eligible population. Spokeswoman Sarah Finnernan said it's voluntary for staff to report for their vaccine status, and that vaccines received off-site may not have been reported. Rates at county jails in Iowa are harder to monitor, as there is no overall tracking of cases or vaccinations in the facilities, as each county's sheriff's office operates independently. Lynn County Sheriff Brian Gardner said roughly 80 inmates at the Lynn County Correctional Center have been vaccinated against COVID-19 since the shots were made available to incarcerated individuals. Gardner said vaccines are provided to inmates on a voluntary basis and upon request. Gardner said the jail is responsible for the individuals it locks up, which includes medical needs. The vaccine, he said, is just another facet of that. For inmates who want to be vaccinated, Gardner said, they fill out a request slip and their name is added to a list. Once the list has enough names, the jail nurses hold a clinic and administer the vaccines. As for vaccines on the jail staff, Gardner said his office is not tracking that. In Johnson County, 14 inmates have received vaccinations while in custody at the Johnson County Correctional Center. Vaccines, according to the sheriff's office, are provided to inmates upon request and based on Johnson County Public Health's availability. Additionally, the sheriff's office said about 80% of the sheriff's staff is fully vaccinated. Jones County Sheriff Greg Graver said he is aware of only 3 inmates who have requested and received COVID-19 vaccines, one of whom is still housed in the jail there. Most inmates declined the vaccination, he said. When vaccines were first made available to inmates, Graver said jail staff made sure inmates were aware they could get the shot. Those who opted to get the jab, Graver said, were vaccinated inside the facility. The inmates, he said, received the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine to avoid the trouble of having to schedule a second shot. Now, if an inmate there requests a vaccination, Graver said he is transported to the local clinic to get the shot. As for the Jones County Jail staff, Graver said he has not required his employees to report their vaccination status, but he estimated that about 44% of his staff is vaccinated. It is my personal belief that I have an obligation to protect not only the employees, but the inmates housed here at our facility, Graver told the Gazette in an email. We do not mandate employees or inmates to get the vaccine, but try to accommodate if they do wish to receive it. I believe having vaccinated employees and inmates protects not only our employees, but the inmate population we are responsible for. Tama County Sheriff Dennis Cusera said that up until last week, no inmate there had requested a COVID-19 vaccine. Then, one did. And he's been in the jail for more than a year, the sheriff said. He's been here since May of 2020 and hadn't asked to be vaccinated until now. Cusera said the jail has no medical staff on site that could give the vaccine, which means the inmate would have to be taken out of the jail to be vaccinated. I don't believe that's in the best interest of the inmates or the jail staff, he said. Plus, it's a security risk. Cusera said inmates at the Tama County Jail, there are about 15, have little risk of exposure because each prisoner is quarantined for 10 to 14 days before being placed into the general population. No inmate or staff member at the Tama County Jail has tested positive for the COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic, the sheriff said. The Johnson County Correctional Center has also gone the entire duration of the pandemic without one positive COVID-19 case among its inmates, according to the Johnson County Sheriff's Office. There have been 8 reported cases, however, among staff members. Many state prisons and county jails have seen at least one case, if not multiple outbreaks, of the virus in the past 18 months. Since the start of the pandemic, Gardner said, a total of 48 inmates in Linn County have tested positive for COVID-19. Additionally, he said, 35 staff members have tested positive, but there have been no deaths among the Linn County inmates or staff as the result of COVID-19, he said. In Jones County, Sheriff Graver said he was aware of one inmate who was symptomatic and had received a positive test before coming into the jail. That inmate was isolated within the facility from other inmates until their quarantine period was over, Graver said. Additionally, the sheriff said only one staff member has tested positive for the virus. That employee, the sheriff said, was quarantined until symptom-free and then cleared to return to work. A related article is titled, Inmate Population Up Over a Year Before, but Still Down from Record, by Rod Beauchart, Dateline Des Moines. The number of inmates held in Iowa prisons crept up last fiscal year, but the population was down significantly from the record count of a decade ago, as COVID-19 has forced policymakers to adjust to changing dynamics the virus has created within institutional settings. New data released by the Iowa Department of Corrections shows 7,744 inmates were housed in the state's 9 correctional institutions in Anamosa, Clarinda, Fort Dodge, Mitchellville, Oakdale, Fort Madison, Mount Pleasant, Newton, and Rockwell City. At the end of the 2021 fiscal year, that was up 175 from the previous count on June 30th, 2020, but well below the record of 9,009 inmates held behind bars in the state's correctional system on April 9th, 2011, when the prisoner count exceeded the system's design capacity by 22%, according to state records. The fiscal 2021 offender count was 12% above the capacity of 6,933. Inmate numbers dropped below 8,000 for the first time in 20 years, last fiscal year when COVID-19 moved into Iowa in March 2020, causing the Iowa Board of Parole to accelerate releases as a way to help manage a prison population that was susceptible to the spreading coronavirus. The numbers are different from these last 2 years from what we've seen historically, and COVID was absolutely a component in why some of our numbers are changing. There's no way around that, said Corrections Department spokeswoman Sarah Finneran. COVID affected nearly every single avenue of the criminal justice system, whether it be criminal case processing to jail admissions to Department of Corrections admissions and exits, Finneran said. It's just so difficult to try to pinpoint one precise cause or really even take big takeaways from this information because COVID had such a wide-reaching impact in every single sector of the criminal justice system. Delays in court hearings, trials, and procedures due to COVID-19 concerns also impacted prison numbers. The 1,207 new court commitments were the lowest since 1,240 offenders were admitted into Iowa's penal institutions in fiscal 1991, according to department records. That followed 1,614 new commitments in fiscal 2020, a 25% year-to-year decline, as corrections officials continue what they call a slow and steady build back up of the overall prison population. Probation revocations, parole returns, and work release returns all experienced declines ranging from 20% to nearly 40% as total prison admissions last year plunged to 3,529, the lowest yearly intake since fiscal 1993. Likewise, overall releases of 3,343 were the lowest since fiscal 1993, but more than 3,000 higher than fiscal 2020 as state officials work to create more space for quarantine areas and prevention measures to address institutional outbreaks. Our COVID numbers are far more manageable now, said Finneran. We've passed our learning curve, and now it's much more manageable than the initial outbreaks that we experienced. Parole board representatives were not available for comment, but data showed a more aggressive approach to identifying lower-risk offenders who would be eligible for parole or work release since the pandemic began in March of 2020. Corrections officials noted 1,270 staff members and 1,354 inmates had been fully vaccinated by late spring. Mindy Tennapal of the Iowa Department of Human Rights Criminal and Juvenile Justice Planning Division, which tracks prison population trends, said the COVID-19 impacts on correctional institutions forced researchers to revise Iowa's projections of prison populations downward. The projections had topped 10,000 in future years. The long-term forecast predicts the population will increase to 8,485 by the end of fiscal 2030, resulting in overcapacity of 22.4%, according to a 35-page report authored by Tennapal and two associates. The fiscal 2021 estimate included in the report was off by just one. Tennapal said prison population numbers likely will increase as offenders bound for prison are transferred from temporary custody in county jails and as court proceedings gradually return to a more normal case docket. The overall reduction in the prison population has resulted in the ability for prisons to create space necessary for large quarantine areas should a facility experience an outbreak of COVID-19, according to the division's report. While space creation within prisons is necessary to reduce the spread of the virus, it is important to note that social distancing is challenging in a correctional setting, particularly amongst facilities with shared cells. The report's authors recommended policymakers consider equalizing quantities for illegal drug possession levels and sentencing for offenses involving crack and powder cocaine to address racial incarceration disparities, as well as revisiting special sentences, mandatory minimums, and drug offense sentencing that are contributors to the prison population. As of last week, corrections officials said there were 7,171 males and 586 females incarcerated in Iowa's prison system. Demographically, 4,971 inmates were white, 1,967 were African Americans, 557 were Hispanic, 179 Native American or Alaska Native, and 81 Asian or Pacific Islander. Data through August 13th indicated 6,062 incarcerated individuals had been fully vaccinated for COVID-19, with about 71% of the total inmate population being held in Iowa prisons fully vaccinated, along with about 61% of prison staff, according to the department. Hospital admissions rise in Linn County, by Michaela Ram. Unless more Linn County residents practice safety mitigation strategies, local hospitals will need to take steps not seen since this past fall to preserve bed capacity for the anticipated surge in new COVID-19 cases, officials say. The highly contagious Delta variant of the novel coronavirus has caused a sudden surge in infections in Linn County over the past few weeks, causing a spike in COVID-19 deaths and hospitalizations, even among the fully vaccinated residents. Officials with Cedar Rapids Hospitals and Linn County Public Health are urging all eligible residents to get vaccinated. They also encourage everyone, even those who are fully vaccinated, to wear masks in indoor public settings and avoid crowded gatherings, among other mitigation strategies. COVID-19 cases have increased in the preceding 2 weeks at a pace that, if it continues, it will trigger both hospitals to initiate contingencies to redirect resources to take care of COVID-19 patients, as we did last fall and in the spring of 2020, Dr. Dustin Arnold, Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital Chief Medical Officer, said during a virtual news conference Tuesday. These contingencies include delaying routine and preventive care, such as non-emergent surgeries. Arnold said individuals who need critical care still would be able to receive it. We want to prevent that scenario, Arnold said. COVID-19 cases have increased significantly in the past 5 weeks, Linn County Public Health Director Pramod Dwivedi said. 9 Linn County residents have died since August 1st, he added. Dwivedi said 83% of all reported cases in the county over the past month are caused by the Delta variant, which was first identified in the state in May. Linn County and 90 other counties statewide were reporting a high level of community transmission earlier this week, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Mercy Medical Center recorded 33 hospitalized COVID-19 patients as of Tuesday, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Tony Myers said. By comparison, the hospital only saw between 1 to 4 patients a day throughout June and July. St. Luke's, which had 21 COVID-19 admissions as of Tuesday morning, reported a similar trend. During the peak this past November, both Cedar Rapids hospitals were reporting at least 50 COVID-19 patient admissions. The majority of hospitalized patients continues to be unvaccinated individuals, but officials have seen a number of breakthrough cases among vaccinated patients. As of Friday, Arnold said 17% of COVID-19 patients were fully vaccinated, but that situation is changing quickly, Myers said. Vaccinated patients admitted for COVID-19 at Mercy Medical rose from 15% to 35% over a period of a week and a half. By far, the clear majority of our critically ill patients are still unvaccinated. But I want people that are vaccinated to realize that we are still at significant risk, Myers said. Hospitals are also seeing a number of their fully vaccinated staff test positive for the virus in recent weeks following intense exposure to the virus, Myers said. That includes prolonged indoor gatherings with multiple people without masks or social distancing. Local hospitals have an adequate bed capacity and enough supplies of personal protective gear, ventilators, and other needed supplies to care for patients, but maintaining staff capacity remains a major concern for hospital officials. State coronavirus data shows case counts as well as COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths have been on the rise across Iowa. Local officials' pleas come this week as K through 12 school districts and colleges resume in-person learning and following large public events that included the Iowa State Fair. Earlier this week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration gave full authorization to the vaccines developed by Pfizer-BioNTech, which some experts say could pave the way for increased vaccinated rates nationwide. However, it's unclear to local officials whether it will move the needle in Linn County. Based on the latest state coronavirus data, about 54% of the county population is fully vaccinated. We don't know how much that will help us with regard to vaccine hesitancy, but at least this provides another assurance to our neighbors that it's really safe and effective, Dwivedi said. In addition to getting the vaccine, it's important that residents take a layered approach moving forward, said Heather Meter, Clinical Services Supervisor at Linn County Public Health. It's not the vaccine all by itself, it's that layered approach, Meter said. We did this before, as a community coming together to do these layered approaches and working together, we were able to get through last November. As part of that layered approach, the most important step individuals can take is to get vaccinated if they are eligible, Meter said. All county residents should wear masks indoors and in other crowded public settings. Individuals also should maintain social distancing when possible, wash hands frequently, and stay home when they are sick. It's important that people get tested for COVID-19 if they are experiencing symptoms, Meter said. Those who test positive should follow isolation guidelines, and those who are exposed should isolate, even if they are fully vaccinated. Turning to page 2, trial reset to next year for Cedar Rapids man charged with fatally beating his mother, by Trish Mahaffey. A trial for a Cedar Rapids man accused of robbing and fatally beating his 71-year-old mother has been reset again to next year. George Deason, 51, is charged with first-degree murder, assault on a peace officer with a dangerous weapon, and interference with official acts with a dangerous weapon. He is accused of assaulting his mother, Elsie Mae Deason, in an attempt to steal about $50 from her in her home, where he also lived, on June 30th of last year. The murder charge was added after Elsie Deason died from her injuries July 23rd of last year. She had life-threatening head injuries and also facial injuries, according to court documents. The trial was set for November, but both the prosecution and defense needed more time to prepare for the trial and to go through all the evidence, including police body camera and squad vehicle camera recordings, and take depositions. The complaint stated that Deason wasn't in his mother's home at 808 18th Avenue Southwest when police arrived and found her with severe injuries to her head and face and was taken to a hospital. George Deason was found a short time later by police near the Playtime Tap, 802 15th Avenue Southwest. He had several warrants for his arrest in separate offenses of theft and forgery and refused to surrender, claiming he had a gun as he began to swing a slapjack, a leather strap that contains lead, at officers. Officers subdued Deason, and then he kicked an officer while armed with the slapjack. Deason has previous convictions for assaulting police officers, kicking and spitting on deputies, and resisting officers. If Deason is convicted of first-degree murder, he faces a mandatory life in prison without parole. Perry to step down as Englert director, by Diana Nolan. After more than a year full of changes, leadership is changing at the Englert Theater in downtown Iowa City. Andre Perry, executive director for 11 years, has resigned to pursue new projects. His final day is September 13th, but he will help finalize fall and spring programming already underway and will continue as executive director for the upcoming Witching Hour Festival and Mission Creek Festival in 2022. Marketing director John Schickedanz has been named interim executive director while the Englert board launches a national search to fill the position. Perry also will assist the search for a new senior programming manager. The most important step I took as a leader was knowing when to move on and make space for a new visionary voice, Perry said in announcing his departure. Perry has led the nonprofit arts presenter through growing from an $800,000 budget in 2010 to a $1.9 million budget in 2019. He helped secure grants that sustained the organization through the pandemic, including the most recent award of $550,868 through the federal Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program announced in July. He also expanded the Englert's reach in the region through partnerships with venues with Gabe's and The Mill in Iowa City and the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids and events. That's a lot of thunder. And events like the recent Iowa City Downtown Block Party. He also founded Mission Creek and Witching Hour festivals showcasing high-profile and emerging artists, as well as local musicians, authors, poets, and creators. And he served as executive director and collaborator for the Strengthen, Grow, Evolve project that has raised $5.5 million to bolster renovations at the Englert and expansion of Film Scene's footprint in downtown Iowa City. University of Iowa meta-analysis pioneer Frank Schmidt dies at 77. By Vanessa Miller, Dateline Iowa City. Although he was an academic titan and pioneer of the widely used meta-analysis research method, University of Iowa Professor Emeritus Frank L. Schmidt's friends and intellectual children and grandchildren say they'll also remember his humanity and generosity. Frank did nothing less than change how we think about and summarize statistical findings in psychology, Rice University psychology professor Fred Oswald wrote on Twitter after hearing of Schmidt's death. Personally, I was scared to meet him at first because of the force of his writing. Turns out he's the nicest person you'd ever want to meet. Schmidt, 77, of Iowa City, died of a heart attack Saturday. Having joined the University of Iowa Tippey College of Business faculty in 1985 and developed research tools and methods over the years that changed global thinking about psychology and statistical findings, Schmidt still was doing work and research at Iowa when he died. Frank has never actually retired, so the news that he left us felt so unreal. University of Texas at San Antonio professor Hui Li wrote on a memorial page, "I'm certain that many, many years from now, when most of us have been mostly forgotten, people will still remember Frank's name and his contributions." Among Schmidt's offerings to the field of psychology and data analysis were two research methods, validity generalization and meta-analysis. His validity generalization work confirmed the legitimacy of employment and hiring tools like tests, interviews, and assessments. It changed the way researchers and practitioners think about selection methods in what amounts to a paradigm shift in employment selection, according to Schmidt's biography, noting direct employment impacts for companies like Ford Motor Company and the U.S. government and military. His work developing meta-analytic methods with fellow researcher Jack Hunter, who died in 2002, explicated his validity generalization work for use in any research field for ever-changing statistical significance testing. Schmidt published 200-plus articles and book chapters on personnel selection, meta-analysis, and selection method validity. He co-wrote 6 books and received top awards from the likes of the American Psychological Association and the Association for Psychological Science. He was a senior scientist for Gallup, the Washington, D.C.-based analytics company known for its public opinion polls. Frank was one of a handful of the single most impactful mentors and collaborators I've had a chance to work with, and I've been very lucky in that regard, Gallup chief scientist Jim Harder wrote on the memorial page. I've said many times to others and to him that he changed how I think about the complexity and practicality of science. He changed how I think, and that changed my career and my life. That personal impact resonated throughout the voices remembering Schmidt, born into a farm family in Louisville, Kentucky, who earned degrees at Bellarmine College and Purdue University before joining the Michigan State University faculty in the 1970s and embarking on his influential collaboration with psychology professor Hunter. UI management and entrepreneurship professor Amy Colbert said she was one of Schmidt's doctoral students 20 years ago, taking 5 courses from Schmidt, who shaped her research path and recruited her back years later. Schmidt was among those who interviewed Colbert for the job, and as hiring strategies are among his areas of expertise, she recalled Schmidt asked the hardest questions that I've ever had. But Schmidt managed to balance that tenacity with a conscientious humanity for everyone he met, according to Colbert, who recalls taking a tough course from Schmidt decades ago while pregnant. He was so generous with his time and always was there to answer questions, she said. After Colbert had her baby, she brought him in to meet everyone, and when Schmidt spoke, the infant turned his head and looked. I swear he recognized Frank's voice because he probably, in the womb, heard him talking for at least 3 or 4 hours a week, she said, of her son, who now is a UI junior studying health and human physiology. So I think Ben probably picked up a little bit of methods expertise from Frank, too. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, August 25th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Joshua Rawson Behill, Cedar Rapids. Joshua Rawson Behill, 28, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully August 21st, 2021. A visitation will be held from 1:30 to 3 p.m. Friday, August 27th, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A memorial service will follow the visitation and begin at 3 p.m. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Lillian Marie Loomis, Cedar Rapids. Lillian Marie Loomis, 87, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died Sunday, August 22nd, 2021, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Graveside services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, August 27th, at the Overlook section of Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cedar Rapids, assisted the family with arrangements. Joseph Drejos, Cedar Rapids. Joseph Drejos, 33, died suddenly on August 22, 2021, as a result from a long struggle with epilepsy. A visitation gathering for family and friends will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 22nd, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. A private graveside service will be held for immediate family only. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Iowa Epilepsy Foundation. Epilepsy Foundation, Iowa, Joe's name in the memo, 1111 9th Street, Suite 370, Des Moines, Iowa, 50314. Or make a donation to plant a tree in his honor where he played as a child. Go to GoFundMe.com, Memorial Tree for Joe. John Michael Wagner, Cedar Rapids. John Michael Wagner, 75, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, August 21, 2021, at St. Luke's Hospital following a short battle with cancer. Friends may visit with the family from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday at Tea and Funeral Home. Private family burial will take place at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Online condolences can be left at teaandfuneralhome.com. Cameron Cam James Bunch, Cedar Rapids. Cameron Cam James Bunch, 19, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Thursday, August 19, 2021. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 26th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel Stateroom. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, August 27th, at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Interment will follow immediately. Memorial donations may be directed to the family, where they will be used to advocate for mental illness and awareness in honor of Cameron. Online condolences are welcome at cedarmemorial.com under obituaries. Jeanette Tia Joyce, Cedar Rapids. Jeanette T. Joyce of Meridian, Idaho, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully, surrounded by family on Thursday, August 19, 2021, after a nine-month battle with cancer. Janet's wishes were to be cremated with a celebration of life to take place in her backyard at 5:30 p.m. Wednesday, August 25th. Patricia Louise Bueller, Cedar Rapids. Patricia Louise Bueller, 85, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away Monday, August 23, 2021, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy, Hiawatha, Iowa, after a short battle with cancer. A rosary service will be held at 4 p.m. Friday, August 27th, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood, Cedar Rapids, where a visitation will follow from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Funeral Mass will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 28th, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to the family. Please share a memory of Patricia at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Richard Jedlicka, Tipton. The family of Richard Jedlicka will be holding a memorial gathering from 2 to 5 p.m. Saturday, August 28th, at the VFW Club in Tipton, Iowa. Richard passed away on April 7, 2020, but due to health concerns for everyone, a gathering was postponed until a later date. Please come share a story and have some refreshments. Mary Rose Lockridge. Mary Rose Lockridge was born June 10, 1935, in Sigourney, Iowa, the daughter of Jess and Hazel Fry Northrup. On June 15, 1951, Mary was united in marriage to Ardith Lockridge in Sigourney. A private family service will be held in the North English Cemetery at a later date. Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg is caring for Mary and her family. Messages and tributes may be left at powellfuneralhomes.com. David Foley, Cedar Rapids. David Wayne Foley, 59, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Hopkinton, born July 3, 1962, died August 21, 2021, after a recent diagnosis of lung cancer. He will be missed by all of us. Please join us as we celebrate his life from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, August 28th, at 299 West 8th Avenue, Marion, Iowa. A tribute and prayer will take place at 2 p.m. Robert Bob Farley Coggan. Robert Bob Farley, 85, of Coggan, died August 23, 2021, at St. Luke's Hospital. Sympathy wishes and cards may be sent to Bonnie Farley at 309 2nd Street South, Coggan Avenue, or Coggan, Iowa, 52218. A celebration of life will be held Saturday at the Coggan Fire Department. Doris Louise Hughes. Doris Louise Hughes, 96, of Iowa City, passed away August 22, 2021, after a brief illness. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations be made to Oaknell Foundation, First Methodist Church, or Iowa City Hospice. No public services are being planned at this time. For a complete obituary and to share a thought, memory, or condolence with her family, please visit the funeral home website, gayandsia.com. Stephen M. Kremkes, Independence. Stephen M. Kremkes, 69, of Independence, Iowa, died August 21, 2021, in rural Independence. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 27th, at St. John's Catholic Church in Independence, with the Reverend David Beckman presiding. Burial will be held at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Independence. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7:30 p.m. Thursday, August 26th, at Rife Family Center, Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. A rosary will be said at 4 p.m. and a parish vigil service will be held at 7:30 p.m. Thursday. In lieu of flowers, please send donations to the Steve Kremkes Memorial Fund at any Bank Iowa location. To leave an online condolence, please go to rifefamilycenter.com under obituaries. Eldo W. Schoenhorst, Iowa City. Eldo W. Schoenhorst, 94, of Iowa City, died August 22, 2021, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, surrounded by family. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Friday, August 27th, at Zion Lutheran Church in Iowa City, where the family will greet guests an hour prior to the service at the church. Burial will be at 2 p.m. at Harlington Cemetery in Waverly, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, please direct memorials to the Ark of Southeast Iowa, Shelter House, or Zion Lutheran Church. A full obituary may be viewed and online condolences may be made at lensingfuneral.com. Betty A. O'Brien, Iowa City. Betty A. O'Brien, 96, of Iowa City, passed away Sunday, August 22, 2021, at Atrium Village in Iowa City. Visitation will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday at Lensing Funeral Service in Iowa City. Funeral services will begin at 11 a.m. Monday at the funeral home. Private burial will follow at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. Instead of food, flowers, and plants, the family suggests memorials to Mid-Continent Railway Museum in North Freedom, Wisconsin, or Atrium Village in Hills, Iowa. Hazel Gertrude Probasco, Manchester. Hazel Gertrude Probasco, 95, of Grimes, formerly of Manchester, Iowa, passed away Monday, August 23, 2021, at Kennybrook Village in Grimes. Funeral service 3 p.m. Sunday, August 29th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester, with the Reverend Phil Rogers officiating. Visitation 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, August 29th, at the funeral home. Private family interment, Oakland Cemetery, Manchester, Iowa. Online condolences may be sent to leonardmullerfh.com. Dorothy Marie Lake, Manchester. Dorothy Marie Lake, 95, of Manchester, Iowa, formerly of Colesburg, passed away Tuesday, August 24, 2021, at the Meadows in Manchester. Left to cherish her memory are her five children. Massive Christian burial, 11:30 a.m. Friday, August 27th, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester, with the Reverend Herbert Pins officiating. Visitation, 8 to 11 a.m. Friday, August 27th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Interment at St. Patrick's Catholic Cemetery, Colesburg, Iowa. John Vernon Robinson, Marion. John Vernon Robinson of Marion, Iowa, died unexpectedly of natural causes on Friday, August 20th, 2021. John, the fourth of five children born to Margaret and John and George Francis, or Robbie Robinson, was born May 15th, 1949, in Ottumwa, Iowa. Per his wishes, John will be cremated, and his remains will be interred near his parents in Ottumwa, Iowa. In light of current COVID restrictions, there will be a later celebration of John's life for friends and family. Please share your support and memories with John's family on his tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com under obituaries. Patricia Biderman, Mount Vernon. Patricia Ann Biderman, 76, of Mount Vernon, Iowa, died August 4th, 2021, at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, under the wonderful care of the hospice unit. At her request, the family held a private celebration of her life. In lieu of flowers, please donate to the Hospice Foundation of America. Martin John, Marty, Jungi, Van Horn. Martin John, Marty, Jungi, 67, passed away Sunday, August 22, 2021, at his home in Van Horn following a sudden illness. A visitation will be held from 2 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 26th, at Phillips Funeral Home in Keystone. A private family burial will take place Friday morning, August 27th, and his life will be honored with a luncheon and a celebration of life at noon, Friday, August 27th, with a memorial service at the Keystone Turner Hall. Online condolences may be made at phillipsfuneralhomes.com. In other notices from Brooklyn, Iowa, Jerry E. Dale, 83, died Tuesday, August 24th, 2021, Cluster Funeral Home, Brooklyn. Cedar Rapids. Mary Ellen O'Malley Zoll, 94, formerly of Cedar Rapids and Dubuque, died Saturday, August 21st, 2021, Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory in Dubuque. Decorah. Constance Connie H. Bolson, 96, died Saturday, August 22nd, 2020, Fjostel Funeral Home in Decorah. Elkader. Viola Ida Melinda Schroeder, 97, died Monday, August 23rd, 2021. Shuti Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Monona. Kelowna. Dean A. Schrock, 65, died Sunday, August 22nd, 2021. Beatty Petersheim Funeral Home, Washington. Keystone. Dylan Dvorak, 29, died Sunday, August 22nd, 2021. Robert Newhouse Funeral Service, Belle Plaine. Monticello. Linda Fitzsimmons, 78, died Monday, August 23rd, 2021. Getch Funeral Home, Monticello. And Quasqueton. Chad Schwarting, 48, died Saturday, August 14th, 2021. Rife Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory, Independence. Turning to the sports page, a title is Party in Back and Front, Iowa Football Offensive Line by Jeff Johnson, Dateline, Iowa City. There always was two distinctive things about Connor Colby when he was at Cedar Rapids Kennedy High School, his size and his mullet. If anything, the true freshman tackle for the Iowa Hawkeyes has gotten even bigger since he enrolled in college for second semester this past school year. He's listed at 6'6" and 298 pounds. The mullet? Still going, the soft-spoken Colby said with a smile. It was interesting to see the big mullet man listed on the initial fall camp 2-deep roster for Iowa, which is preparing for its season opener in a week and a half against Indiana. He is number 2 at right tackle behind sophomore Nick DeYoung. Wide receiver Keegan Johnson is the other true freshman on the 2-deeps, a backup to Tyrone Tracy, Jr. For me, that really doesn't mean much, Colby said. I'm just going to come out here with the rest of the guys and keep working. Keep my head down and keep working. I can't predict anything. We'll see how it falls. Iowa's offensive line is anchored by as sure of a thing as you'll get in an All-American center, Tyler Linderbaum. But other than him, the starting spots are sort of up for grabs, especially now that the guard Kyler Schott is out a number of weeks with a foot injury incurred while baling hay on his parents' farm. Going into fall camp, junior Jack Plum was listed as the starter at left tackle with redshirt freshman Mason Richmond backing him up. Junior Cody Ince is number 1 at left guard with redshirt freshman Tyler Ellsbury behind him. Justin Britt has taken over starter's duties for Schott at right guard. There is some flexibility here, with guys able to play multiple spots. I think the big thing you see is kids trying to take advantage of opportunities, said first-year offensive line coach George Barnett. Not only trying, but doing that. They have done a really nice job of showing up and working. It's a tight-knit group. Guys really respect each other in that offensive line room. They've been through a lot of games together. Whether they're playing or not playing, the next man in mentality is certainly in play. Barnett said he has been impressed with Colby, a four-star recruit who committed to Iowa in June of 2019, the summer before his junior year. The coach said he believes Colby could even slide inside to a guard spot if the need arose. If he stays healthy, there's little doubt he'll receive some playing time. He is a kid. You have to remind yourself sometimes of his age, Barnett said. I mean, he should have been going to prom last spring. Instead, he was here, working hard. The kid loves football. He's a joy to be around. The best way I can describe him is like he's like my son in a Little League baseball game. He'll strike out twice, and then he'll hit a bomb, and that's all you hear about all the way home. He has a unique ability to move on. For an offensive lineman, that's important. Colby said the adjustment to major college football is ongoing, as you'd imagine. He was asked about Barnett's comment about being able to move on after a bad play. Don't try to perfect everything, he said. You are going to make mistakes. You've just got to learn from them. I think I get that from my dad. He always told me to worry about the next game. The kid has the endorsement of his center, by the way. It all starts with the spring practices when he first came in here, Linderbaum said. Just how fast he has been able to pick up stuff, I think, is pretty special. In my time here, I haven't seen a freshman come in and be able to do the things he's been able to do. Just understanding things. The playbook, obviously. There are a lot of things that go into it. Being able to pick up things as fast as he's done has been impressive. Linderbaum went on with his praise of Colby. Then, technique-wise, I think that's something that he's excellent at, from the spring all the way until the fall camp here, he said. Obviously, there is a crap ton of stuff he's got to work on, but he's headed in the right direction. In high school football, the headline is Independence in Position to Erupt by Mike Condon. Dateline, Independence. All the ingredients are there. As the Independence football team prepares for Friday night's home opener at Lyle Linebaugh Field against Maquoketa, the Mustangs understandably are optimistic coming off a 6-2 season that ended with a loss to traditional Class 3A power Solon in the round of 16. Coach Justin Putz has the luxury of returning a second-team All-State running back in Marcus Beatty, starting quarterback Mitch Johnson, and standout receiver Keegan Schmidt. It is nice to start the season with guys who not only have experience but performed at a high level last season, said Putz, starting his 8th season with the Mustangs. We were in the opposite position last season, so having these guys to rely on has been great. It has helped us hit the ground running this fall. Not only does Putz have 3 returning skill players with experience, he has 3 guys who have gone above and beyond since the end of the 2020 season. Those 3 players, Marcus, Mitch, and Keegan, have had great off-seasons, Putz said. All of them are multi-sports players who have had success in other sports. That kind of experience is so valuable and, as a coach, very comforting. Defenses will have a tough chore going against Independence. Beatty, a 5'10", 200-pound senior, ran for 1,515 yards and 15 touchdowns in 2020. He also caught 8 passes for 193 yards and 3 scores. Johnson, a 6-foot, 180-pound junior, completed 64 of 124 passes for 1,055 yards and 17 TDs. Schmidt, a 5'9", 160-pound senior, had 22 catches for 250 yards and 3 scores. We feel like we have the pieces to be explosive on offense, Putt said. I feel like our skill players have some ability and we should be pretty balanced with the run and pass game. Last season, Independence was a young, inexperienced team, entering a season with almost no off-season work due to COVID-19. As the record shows, the young players matured and improved as the season went along. It was great to be able to do 7-on-7, installs, group weights, and camp again, Putt said. Our kids are further along now than maybe where we ended last season in terms of what we are able to run. It has been nice to have most of that back. Putz is looking for them to take the next step in 2021, especially from a physicality standpoint. Last year, we were very young by varsity football standards, Putz said. We started a couple of freshmen, 4 sophomores, and a lot of juniors. All of them performed very well and got better each week. I am excited to see what those guys can do this year after another year in the weight room and becoming comfortable on the field. That improved physical play should also extend to the defensive side of the ball. The Mustangs returned 8 starters on defense. Traditionally, we have been pretty solid on defense year in and year out, Putt said. We expect our guys to play smart and disciplined assignment football. Putt sees West Delaware as the favorite in the District 3 race. I think if things break well for us, we should be in the mix to compete for a district title, he said. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, August 25th, 2021. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.